ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
We just acquired a retired greyhound and she's nearly 4 years old. Her first 3.5 years of life, she's a professional racing greyhound. She's not somebody's pet. But still in all, she had enough contact with people, even in that environment, that she loves people. She absolutely loves people. And so, yeah, so with dogs, this trusting nature, this engagement that make a dog, I have to do with an exaggerated capacity for strong emotional connections. This new dog that we have in our home, you bring in a new dog, you think, is this gonna work? Are we gonna have a relationship like I had with previous dogs in my life? And the dog just makes it work. The dog doesn't wait for me to warm up to her. She's there inviting me to love her.
Oh, that is beautiful. Yeah, but Clive, if you die in your house, is that dog going to eat you?
Yeah. Oh, it happens all the time. It happens all the time. It doesn't happen all the time. But if a person dies inside a house with a dog inside the house and the person is not found in fairly short order, then the dog will start eating the person.
On ABC Radio National, this is What the Dog. This is What the Duck. And I'm Dr. Anne Jones. This season is all about the science of dogs. We've looked at where they've come from. Spoiler alert, it's wolves. How we've tamed them. Spoiler alert, they probably tamed themselves. And how we've created a literal library of dog breeds, but only in the last 150 years. And now, we're looking at just how far this friendship goes. So look deep into these puppy dog eyes, because this is Dogs, Chapter 3, Survival of the Friendliest. In the course of making these programs, every conversation I've had ends like this. The dog person says, if the house is burning down, a dog will go and get help. Your cat will watch you die and then eat you. What's that, lassie? Timmy's under-researching and over-generalising? Let's bury this bone of contention once and for all with Clive Wynne, Professor of Psychology at Arizona State University.
I specialise in the behaviour of dogs in human society, how people and dogs live together.
The perfect man to tell us if dogs will save us, like they're full-blown members of the State Emergency Service. Is there any truth, you think, to a dog being a superhero like Lassie?
Oh, well, so we did an experiment on this, right?
Of course you did, Clive. Now, we don't expect a kangaroo to pull us out of a burning building because of Skippy, but for some reason, the idea that dogs are interchangeable with heroes has stuck.
Would a dog actually help somebody who is in distress? I don't believe that dogs, on average, are terribly clever. So I wanted to make it easy for them.
Ouch! But also, I did once see a dog get a fright from the sound of its own fart. So, fair.
So we built a box that wasn't much more than a coffin, really, with air holes, and a front door that was very easy to open. We wanted it to be as simple as we could make it. And we had people climb inside this box and cry out in distress, help, help me, help, help me. And then we put the dog in the room with the box, no other people there. What does the dog do? Will the dog open the box and rescue their human being? Now, we did 60 dogs and their owners, and 20 of them opened the box and rescued their human being. Now, 20 out of 60, that's 1 in 3. But the question of importance then becomes, does that mean only 1 dog in 3 loves their owner? Or does it mean that only 1 dog in 3 can understand how to open the box?
Clive and the team decided to test this by replacing the owner with a yummy treat. And they dropped that treat into the box.
It would land in the tray at the bottom, and it made a good sound when it hit the tray at the bottom. It made a good clonk.
Will the dog be able to open the box for a little treaty?
We found the exact same proportion. 20 out of 60 dogs opened the box to get the treat, just like 20 out of 60 opened the box to rescue their owner. Now, we know that they were motivated to get the treat, and only 1 in 3 understood what to do. So I believe that the reason only 1 in 3 rescued their owner wasn't because they weren't motivated, it was because they couldn't figure out what needed to be done.
Okay, nightmare scenario. You've been presumed dead, but you're actually alive, and you're in a coffin, and you're just about to get buried alive. Yeah, your dog might be able to tell you're in there, but don't rely on them to get help. But I mean, come on, a coffin and dogs in a room with someone weakly crying out for help. I mean, surely this is a one-off experiment, because science is a serious business.
Have you seen this YouTube clip, Anne?
Oh, tell me about it. That's Dr. Mia Cobb, a canine welfare scientist at the University of Melbourne.
Oh my God. So Kristen McPherson, a US researcher, did this study where she had people go into basically an empty gymnasium, walk around for a little bit, drop the lead of their dog like they got distracted looking at books on a bookshelf, then basically pull the bookshelf gently over onto themselves and act like they were stranded. When they had walked into this room, initially they had passed a security person in the walkway. And the idea was that dogs could do this full Skippy moment or Lassie and go indicate to that person that their guardian needed help. And dogs did not. Universally, dogs did not.
Rescue? Help, 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 help me, help me, help, help, help.
That's actual audio of the experiment that Clive and his colleagues undertook. And I have to say, it's actually sort of heartbreaking because you can hear the dog responding to the distress of the owner. Your dog might be able to tell that you need help, but simply might not know how to render it. And I think another thing to point out about these studies, say the one where a dog and an owner walk into a field and the owner fakes a heart attack, clutches their chest, falls to the ground, dead. Now the dog is then observed, not going for help. No. But they do often stand by their owner in these experiments. Yes, they do. They do sometimes touch their nose to the owner. Yes, they do. So while untrained dogs might not save us by dialing 000 and tapping out our address in Morse code, the indications are that they do care. And along this evolutionary partnership, they've made a stack of changes to accommodate their relationship with us. And the easiest way of pointing out these changes is by contrasting dogs with wolves.
Wolves form pretty much lifelong pair bonds. They are reproductively active only once a year. That's both the males and the females. The females come into heat only once a year, and the males are also only able to have sex at one period of the year. And then they give birth to a litter of offspring that both mum and dad work together to bring up for at least a year, quite possibly 2 years, maybe some of their offspring hang around for 3 years. Now we come over to dogs, and what's so interesting is that dogs are completely different. Dogs only get together for sex, which they can do at any time of the year. I mean, okay, females come into heat, which we call seasons, but by and large, what time of year females come into heat can be any time of year. And they do this a couple of times a year. Males can and do, unless we cut their private parts out, they can and do have sex all day, every day, right? That's a male
dog. Some of them do seem to be quite obsessed with it.
Yeah, and then that is the male's only contribution to creating the next generation. they have sex. That's all they do. The female may never see the father, the male, again. The offspring may never, ever meet their father. And if they do, they won't know him.
Rover, I am your father. In one scientific review of reproductive systems in canids, wild and domestic, they rated the domestic dog's efforts at caregiving for young meagre. Ouch! And call the doggy social services. So that lasting parental bond and care of the litter, that has been dropped in dogs in favour of year-round flexibility. And why is it, do you think, that dogs have evolutionarily discarded nuclear families in favour of a free love sort of ethos?
See, in biology, everything exists for a reason, for an evolutionary reason. So if we want to understand why wolves have the family structure they have, we ask, what is the life of a wolf? And the life of a wolf is a life of hunting live prey. Not only just hunting live prey, but hunting live prey who are bigger than you are, right? Wolves have to live in communities to be successful. And we call those communities packs, but they are really, by and large, nuclear families. Because if you want to catch a great big deer, you need to be a compact unit of individuals who know each other, who understand each other, who can cooperate to bring down that deer, right? You need that.
And even more interestingly, wolf packs specialize in hunting. So one pack might be elk and another might be deer. And when the young disperse to form new packs, the majority of them will select a mate from another pack that has the same speciality. It's like your parents were cheesemakers, so you'll only be marrying a cheesemaker's son. It's so much more selective than those stories that you hear about prized poodles who accidentally get pregnant from next door's mixed breed, rescued, misbehaving, miscreant and possibly delinquent pet pooch.
Now, dogs, the dominant lifestyle for a dog is scavenging on human rubbish heaps. And I saw a dog in the Bahamas helping himself to something somebody had left in one of those takeaway boxes of KFC, of fried chicken, right? And he's sticking his snout in the box and he's taking out the bits of chicken and the chips that have been left behind. And not only does he not need any other dogs to help him do that, but in point of fact, that box is only really big enough for one dog to get at.
The way the resources, that is human offcasts or meals, are provisioned has meant that the dog is able and actually needs to lead a relatively solitary life in comparison to wolves. But what about the relationship with other species?
So that is another crucial, uncontroversial distinction between dogs and wolves. If an animal has a friendly relationship with a human being, we call that taming. And so you can tame wolves. That's a lot of bother. And even when you've done it, that doesn't mean the animal's not going to bite you, because even though it accepts you as a social companion, as perhaps a family member or a friend, you could still have a misunderstanding about something. Your pet lion might think that it's dinner time. But through the evolution of the dog, through domestication, it's become much, much easier to convince dogs to accept human beings as social companions. It's still true that every puppy who's born has to come across human beings during the first few weeks or months of life if that puppy is going to grow up to be a dog who is then tame. But it's so easy that people don't even talk about it, right? I mean, you don't say, I've got to go home and tame my dog. In the formal sense of a technical, behavioral, biological definition, we are dominant over our dogs. We control their access to resources. We control their access to food. We control their access to the outside world. We control their access to places of shelter when the weather is bad. So that means, in a technical sense, we are dominant over them. At the same time, there's plenty of evidence that they and we have strong emotional bonds, what we call attachments. People have done studies. You can see this in everyday life. You separate your dog from yourself, and then when you come back together, the dog is clearly thrilled that you are back together. You have an emotional attachment.
This is Angel, the Maltese Shih Tzu. A shit tease, if you will, waiting for the door to open up and her people to walk in. This sort of emotional display demonstrates how dogs have specialised in working with us rather than with each other. But what did they lose in the process? It's science story time. Once upon a time in Austria at the Wolf Science Centre, yeah, that's actually a real place, scientists decided to test the teamwork between wolf teams and dog teams. And the task was this. The canids had to each pull a string at the same time to pull a trolley towards them and reveal food. Sort of like a drawer that two handles have to be pulled simultaneously. With a team, you get the food. With an individual, you get nothing. Obviously, everyone was interested in the food. And when they're released into the arena, they all bound across enthusiastically. But the wolves often approached the task together and resolved conflicts as they went. The dogs approach one at a time, avoiding direct conflict where possible. So less squabbles, but no teamwork. And the moral of the story is, wolves succeeded in accessing the food, working together 100 out of 416 times. The dogs had the same number of attempts, 416, but they managed to get the food twice.
Wolves will cooperate with other wolves much more than dogs will cooperate with other dogs.
Interestingly, research has shown that when wolves are habituated to humans and interact, they often take leadership roles. And we let them, because holy shit, it's a wolf and it could easily tear your face off.
But dogs are very ready to cooperate with humans. But I think that's because they recognise that we are in charge and that it's in their interest to cooperate with us. Our dogs help us because they can see that we help them. It's a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of arrangement.
But that doesn't mean there's no feeling or that there's no love.
I've published a book, Dog is Love. I do believe that it's meaningful to say that dogs love us. Obviously, I mean love in a particular sense, attachment, emotional bonding, the kind of love between parent and child. And I think there is plentiful evidence that dogs have an emotional engagement with human beings. Some years ago now, we were actually able to pin down a gene that mutated in the journey from wolf to dog, or actually three genes, that in human beings who have mutations in those genes, which does happen occasionally, these people have an exceptionally loving attitude. And we found that that is mutated, as I say, in the dog, distinct from the wolf.
Clive is referring to Williams-Buren syndrome. The humans who have it are very gregarious, have little fear of strangers, and can be very outgoing. So the fact that one of the genetic differences between wolves and dogs is in this area that correlates to gregariousness is significant. Wolves stick to their own. Dogs are relative social butterflies. Professor Chris Johnson is with the University of Tasmania.
Early in their development, dogs developed emotional intelligence. And they've had that for longer than any other species, because dogs were domesticated about 30,000 years ago, roughly speaking. All the other domestic livestock have been derived within the last 11,000 years.
And I do think it bears reiterating that dogs were the very first domesticated animal, the very first domesticated anything. And that is one of the reasons why their traits and our relationship is so intricate.
So dogs have got three times the length of history with humans that the others have, and they understand us.
Professor Chris Johnson studies the use of guardian livestock dogs for conservation. Now, these are large dogs like Merimas, Anatolian Shepherds or Tibetan Mastiffs that are brought up by humans in such a way that they bond to another animal, like a flock of sheep.
The guardian dogs have transferred some of that emotional connection to their sheep. And you can see this when you watch these dogs at work. If the animals are upset or anxious or distressed, the dogs feel that and they try to resolve it by looking around for a threat.
This might involve patrolling the perimeter or addressing the threat, so they would put themselves in the firing line to save the sheep. It is a jolly swagman's worst nightmare. And ironically, of course, some of the time, they're defending those sheep from other canids. They'll show loyalty to the flock rather than to the same species.
But they do other things that no one ever told them how to do, like midwifery. And I've spoken to several sheep farmers who've had Maremma sheepdogs, and they will talk about how when a ewe goes off to give birth to a lamb, one of the dogs will go with her. If the ewe is cast, you know, sometimes they lie down and they get really stiff and they can't stand up. The dog stays with her until she can stand or until a farmer comes and rescues her. And just after birth, the dog also eats the afterbirth, which is a good tactic for reducing risk of predation because it removes the smell of the birth site. And it helps the lamb to stand up. And when the ewe can walk, the dog will escort them both back to the flock. So that they do all of that without training.
Like Clive said right at the very beginning of this episode, dogs have an exaggerated capacity for strong emotional connections. In 2016, psychologists put a small group of 15 dogs through MRIs to look at how the dog brains lit up with food rewards versus hearing praise. And they found that in 13 of the 15 dogs they studied, the brain lit up in equal or more amounts for praise than for food. So yeah, they're hardwired to get food from us, yes, but they're also hardwired to please us, even with physical traits. Dr. Annika Bremhorst is a dog behaviour researcher with the University of Bern.
There has been one comparative study where they compared wolves and dogs. And what they found was that only dogs have a specific muscle in the eyebrow region that pulls up the eyebrow in order to cause this typical dog look.
This muscle is called the levator anguli oculi medialis.
Dogs might have it, but I bet they can't say it. Dr. Mia Cobb is a research fellow at the Animal Welfare Science Centre at the Melbourne Veterinary School.
And it basically allows them to lift up their inner eyebrows. So to give that what we would call the puppy dog look, and that is not present in wolves. So that suggests that it's developed either through the course or as a result of domestication.
What they also found in this study, where they compared how wolves and dogs respond to a human standing in front of them, was that the dogs pulled up their eyebrows much higher, so higher intensity, but also more often when there was a human in front of them than the wolves.
So the use of eyebrows by dogs was more pronounced when they were in the company of humans. We literally turned them into Groucho Marx eyebrow-waggling machines. Or did we? Did the process of domestication select this ability so they could absolutely manipulate us into being fed scraps off the table?
I think it's probably like it favoured the dogs that did that, because when we see what we call this baby schema, these round faces and big eyes that really elicit a truly biological response in us to want to nurture.
And we know also that humans have a preference for dogs who do these puppy dog's eyes more often, because it has been found that those dogs in shelters who do these puppy dog's eyes more often are adopted faster. So it really seems that humans have a specific preference for this appearance.
How interesting that even today, we're possibly still selecting for dogs with absolutely swole eyebrows. It's the thousands of years of partnerships between humans and dogs that have created the animal that's sitting with you right now. Like the fact that it can breed at almost any time, will eat almost anything, and can accept cohabitants of other species beside its own. And so even though they might not be able to go and get help to save you from underneath a bookshelf inside a research centre, they will be able to put you right at the centre of their universe. Because over the course of their domestication, it's not been a survival of the fittest. It's been survival of the friendliest. Either that or they're manipulative sycophants who are playing the long game and are going to wait around until you die so they can eat the nose straight off of your face. Next time, we go further than puppy dog eyes and get into communication. Do you really understand what your dog is saying? And is it true that they can try to please you so hard that they will give themselves an injury?
There's a thing called happy dog syndrome where they basically overwag their tail.
This episode was produced by me, Dr. Anne Jones, Nat Tenchich and Rebecca McLaren. What the Duck is a production of Radio National and ABC Science, and it's made on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, Jabwurrung and Wadawurrung of the Kulin Nation.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.